Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. We're taping today at Borders Bookstore on Union Square in San Francisco as part of the public radio conference going on in San Francisco. And I have brought Nicholson Baker to talk to a live audience here at Borders Bookstore. My name is Michael Silverblatt. Nicholson Baker is the author, first, of The Balcony, then of Room Temperature, Vox, Fermata, The Size of Thoughts, which was a book of essays, and now of The Everlasting Story of Nori. I thought we'd begin by having Nicholson read a section from the new book published by Random House.
Well, thank you, Michael. This is a book about a 9-year-old girl who's an American girl going to school in England, and she tells herself stories and defends a classmate, and she thinks about a cathedral that's in the town. The owners of the Threlle Cathedral, who were the Anglican bishops and deans, had just spent millions of dollars, or pounds, to clean all the glass in the Jasperium and make sure it wasn't going to fall down. But while they were doing that, they had discovered that death watch beetles had chewed through the lead that covered the ends of the beams of wood that attached the Jasperium to the tops of the stone columns. So they had to replace some of the wood, but not all. Death watch beetles were called that because in former times, when a person was very sick, if his family heard any of these beetles banging their small heads against the wood of the house, it meant that the sick person would die soon. Nori, because she wanted to be a dentist, had a specific thought about this, which was, their teeth must be extraordinarily strong to have chewed through lead. They must be hidden away normally and then fold out when they open their mouths. Crocodiles grow 24 sets of teeth in their lives, and they can perform for 2 years without food. But Nori severely doubted that the Death Watch beetle had more than one set of teeth. It must be a difficult way of life up there, Nori thought. Generation after generation of beetle, trying to find enough to eat in the old, horrible, chewed-over wood. They must be down to the bare gristle. Near the cathedral was a very good tea shop that had an extremely good chocolate fudge cake. The cake was served with a little cup of whipped cream, by the way. Nori didn't like a certain picture in one of the brochures that her parents bought about Threlle Cathedral that showed a man wearing a mask, putting a metal tube into one of the old pieces of wood under the Jasperium in order to squirt powerful bug-killing foam inside. She had to make up a story about a family of Death Watch beetles who learned of the approach of a squirt of the poison and packed up their household and made little parachutes out of some candy wrappers one of the bug-killing men had left in the scaffolding, and parachuted down, 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 smuggling through the cool, empty air of the inside of the cathedral, swaying, feelers curled up tight in fear, until they landed in a huge stone land of green light on the cold floor near a little girl with bright eyes and black hair named Mariana. Mariana was sitting with her eyes closed, waiting to see if she could think the thoughts God wanted her to think. She opened her eyes to see how close the light was to her feet, because she thought that as soon as the light touched her feet, she would start to feel the sacred holiness. And she was just creeping her feet a little closer to the light so that the holiness would get there more quickly when she thought she noticed something. Yes, she did notice something. Four tiny creatures carefully folding up a chewing gum wrapper. "Oh, who are you?" she said, bending toward them and letting them hop onto her palm. "We're Death Watch beetles," said one of them. "A bad man is squirting our country full of terrible poison." "Oh," said Mariana, "he isn't a bad man, I'm sure. He just wants to be sure that the Jasperium doesn't fall down. You see, when you eat the wood becomes weaker and weaker, and finally the whole thing would turn to crumbs and fall. You wouldn't want that to happen to the cathedral, would you?" "Well," grudged the Death Watch beetle, "if they'd just explained what the problem was and given us another piece of wood to live in, we would have left on our own. As it is, look at little Gary. He has gotten sick from chewing on the lead." And indeed, Mariana saw that little Gary was lying on his back and he did not look at all well. He looked as pale as a bug can look, and near death. Mariana gently put all four beetles in her pencil case and walked out to the forest. She knew where a special fallen tree lay. There was a pool of rainwater in a groove of this tree, and she picked a certain kind of flower as she went, singing a mild song, and crushed the petals in the water. It was a special kind of flower that could cure any kind of lead poisoning, and it was called the Montezuma flower because it could grow in really hot or very cold places, so that it was a great survivor. Then she opened the pencil case. The three healthy Death Watch beetles carried Gary, the sick one, out. "Wash him in the water," said Mariana gently. She was a tall girl with dark brown hair. "The potion will help him." At first, the beetles weren't sure, and they sniffed the water and tested it with their feelers and that sort of usual behavior. Then, gradually, they lost their fears and dipped Gary freely in, not head first, but gently tail first. And they all went in one by one and splashed in the water contentedly. They had spent so many centuries cooped up inside the old Norman beams of the Jasperium that they had forgotten that rainwater could be so clean and pure, and they were overjoyed. Gary sat up in the water and said he felt much better. Then all four of them found a place in a spot of sun to dry their bodies, and when they were toasty and warm again, they waved goodbye and began chewing their mazes in the huge tree trunk. "Lovely layers of wood," they said. "Rings and rings and rings. It'll be a long time before we chew up this enormous country. Don't tell anyone you brought us here." "I won't," laughed Mariana. "Good luck." "Thank you, Mariana," they called, giving a last happy wave. "Bye, bye." That was a story she made up about them. She makes up a number of stories, and in fact, some of these stories were told by my own real-life daughter, Alice, and some of them are made up by me, and I'll never tell which is which.
Nicholson Baker reading from The Everlasting Story of Nori. Well, is this book a collaboration, Nicholson?
I think it's definitely a collaboration. All my other books are more or less about me or about pieces of my own imagination, but this one is based very closely on the ideas that my daughter had and the way she puts words together, and I wrote it by interviewing her. I would pick her up from school and ask her what happened, and she would tell me, and I'm fortunate in that she's very talkative. But I did enough, I think, sorting and filtering, and I asked the questions that I wanted to know the answers to. So I typed the whole book, at least.
Because there's sort of the feel, you know, one of my favorite things is Beatrice Lilly singing "There Are Fairies at the Bottom of Our Garden." On the one hand, as the audience hears this song, they're thinking of the somewhat secondary use of the word fairy at the time, but she is in fact singing a Victorian children's song, wearing a ball gown, and telling about how the butterflies and bees make a lovely little breeze, and the rabbits sit about and hold the lights. And the further she goes, the more hilarious it becomes to see this rather elegant woman singing such a charming but foolish under the circumstances song. What is the irony level here?
I never know what the irony level is really until the book is finished, and then even then I'm confused. I mean, I think the first book, The Mezzanine, I wrote with a kind of yearning desire to tell the truth about drinking straws and escalators, and it felt as if I was I had these passionate things that I wanted to say, but then somewhere along the line the ironies just popped out, and I guess there is some irony. On the other hand, it seems to me important to catch the way children adjust and make moral decisions and make sense of the soup of cultural references that they're in, and do justice to them, pay kind of respectful attention, and not use their sensibility to illustrate kind of evil truths about grown-ups or something. So I guess there's a fair amount of sincerity here.
Well, what's interesting and most pleasurable to me is that as you read a Nicholson Baker novel, I think this goes for all of them, one in fact does not know from moment to moment what one is reading. The book seems consistent, but one's attitude while reading it changes from minute to minute, so that you're always speculating about whether the author is joking or serious, and at what level. Is this joking at the level of craft? Is it at the level of the audience or the subject? The great thing is that most American writing that toys with irony at all is so one-dimensional. The thrill here is to have a book that seems at every point to both elude and court definition.
Wow, well, that sounds impressive. And let me look that up. And I want books to be funny, because it seems to me that writers should entertain and instruct, and it isn't the writer's job to make people flinch. That's kind of an easy victory. So I would like readers to kind of feel that they were in friendly hands, I guess, so to speak.
But at the same time, in this book, for instance, there seems to be a relatively serious investigation of what meaning is for this girl, Nori, Eleanor. She wants to be a dentist, and she sees in the struts of the cathedral that are being eaten by the dead Death Watch beetles the same kinds of destruction that are going on in teeth by decay. And she starts to put things together. She makes comparisons that only go so far. And it's as if the book is toying with the idea of discovering in a kind of Piaget fashion the moment a meaning can occur securely enough to be real in the mind of the ongoing child.
Maybe the best way to look at the book is that one part of the motive was to supply a kind of case study, that this would be, that it would be, it would have some of the things that novels do, but that it also would offer people a kind of a truer picture of a 9-year-old mind than I never like to see artists who pretend to do kid handwriting, because they never get it quite right. Adult versions of kid handwriting is always, the Y's are wrong or something, and adults' attempts to duplicate children's misspellings are usually wrong, because the kids' misspellings are more interesting, actually. And the only way to do this right is to I think be almost a journalist and interview some actual person and then attempt to make an artful whole out of that. So I was fortunate that I could just go out of my office at any time and say, how would you tell this story? How would you make this transition? And sometimes I allowed my own preoccupations and peeves to work in. So it's a mixture, I guess, of what I remembered from my own 9-year-old life and this 9-year-old that I happen to have available to ask questions of.
You've taken the experience of family life as the occasion for a novel before. Most, I'm particularly thinking of Room Temperature, which is an account of a child's birth. And many of the critics are speaking as if you have turned to the everlasting story of Nori as a vacation from the Sodoms of Vox and the Fermata. I wondered what began the book for you at this point.
I felt I had a real deadline, and most parents, I suppose, lament the fact that the 4-year-old self turns into a 6-year-old self, and the 6-year-old into, so you lose certain bits of vocabulary and ways of thinking as each year goes by. So I felt that if I was going to do justice to this kid, that I really had to write the book now. But also, yes, Room Temperature was about a man who gives a bottle to a baby, and he's sitting in a rocking chair, and he blows a puff of air. And by chapter 7, the puff of air reaches the little mobile that's across the room. So that's the central plot of the book. But there's no speaking part for this child, and so this the heroine of that book is more or less the heroine of this current book. So it isn't as much of a departure. What I seem to do with each book is I write a book, and then there's certain people who are kind enough to like it, and then the next book disappoints that group, but it wins its own adherence, and then that group is disappointed by the next book. So there's a constant kind of disappointment that goes on with my writing career. But the Everlasting Story of Nori is insulated from those two dirty books by a collection of essays that are very pseudo-scholarly, and there's lots of history of the word lumber and books as furniture. And so there isn't as much of a jarring shift, I hope, as it might be initially apparent.
I'm speaking to Nicholson Baker on the occasion of the publication of The Everlasting Story of Nori from Random House. Now, part of the impulse here, as you say, to have the 3-year-old, the 4-year-old, the 6-year-old, is the impulse, I think, in your work for nothing to be lost. I loved, there is a small piece that originally appeared. You know how they put together anthologies of pages from writers' notebooks? Well, Nicholson Baker contributed the contents of his refuse bin from the word processor, you know, the letters that got taken away, the waste, the idea that everything that can be saved is of some interest.
And that's not always true, is it? But yeah, but maybe that's my instinct. I do have a kind of underdog sympathy or something, so that in the case of the first book, I felt that people were writing about it's set in a business setting, and people, there have been plenty of Dreiser-like stories of stocks and bonds or corporate takeovers, junk bonds, but nobody had really written about that feeling of that you get in the lunch hour of kind of going through the revolving door and being out in the sun and going out and buying a pair of shoelaces and coming back, so that the little events were being crowded out by these things that people thought were novel, great events. And so I always, and the, I, you know, say with card catalogs, I felt that, yes, it's nice to convert card catalogs to electronic form, but that I should write an 18,000-word article on why card catalogs still have intellectual value.
Well, you know, it is interesting to find out what does get maintained. I mean, we're living in a culture where we are constantly threatened by records. One mystery that I know of, was it 7? I believe so, has the detective tracking down the murderer by going to the library and finding out what books he's taken out. And we, none of us, want to have our histories of credit preserved for too long a time. So I wondered how you felt when the contents of Miss Lewinsky's bibliography were revealed to the American public.
The rumor was, and I suppose it was a rumor spread by Kenneth Starr's own office, was that one of the books that she had bought was Vox, and then the further conclusion we're supposed to draw is that that book was one of the books that she gave to the president, which is, of course, for me, it's a thrilling thing. I mean, I'm never going to get another chance to be part of this kind of national scandal. And so if that book was traveling around on Air Force One or something, then that's thrilling. On the other hand, it doesn't seem very nice to Monica Lewinsky to use this a noble legal system to extract that kind of information.
Now, I wanted to ask you, Nicholson, there's a kind of charming devolution in your work. If the people in Vox were, what would you say, adult in their sexuality, the narrator of Fermata is as immature a sexual enthusiast as one can find, and now this.
Yeah. Right, looking backward, yeah.
What's happening?
Well, I don't know what's happened. I think each book kind of clears the clears the territory, and then the next book, it's sort of as if you have to clean out the petri dish and then start again with a new fungus or something. But I don't know why. I hadn't noticed that pattern of regression. I think, actually, this is the book that I'm proudest of because it's the first time that I was able to catch a character who was in the middle of a somewhat morally complicated situation. I mean, in a way, it's my most grown-up book, I suppose. I hope there's some signs of progress, but...
Well, it seemed oddly, after these books about sex, to be, in fact, a book almost about death. Is that something that you can...
It's a book about mortality.
And
I mean, it sounds kind of banal or something, but you do lose a childhood, and you can be... And Proust is a nice guy, and I believe in Proustian analysis, but that kind of retrospection is very highly colored and filtered, and the only way that all this world that is lost... that's true of the way kids think. The only way that you can catch that is by treating it as a complete whole and being there on site with a person. So the everlasting story of Nori is really not an everlasting story at all. In fact, to the extent that this book is based on my own daughter's mind, there's a lot of this that she can't remember, and it's only 2 years after the... So this is sort of the only way that a lot of those thinking combinations of thought will ever persist. And so it's really a short-lived story.
But it's something that Nori is finding out as well, too. The everlasting comes in first because she's fond of the movie The Never-Ending Story. And that, you know, seems to refer to length. But the idea of something that does not end because it is immortal. Something, you know, that the sonnets teach us, that art is immortal and that life is brief, seems to be going on here too. For instance, her brother, I think he gets a package of styrofoam and Nori makes him an everlasting box of potato chips out of it. There's a certain experiment going on in how to make things last, and a sense in which this 1 year in England for Nori is going to be one that unless she holds on to it and tells her stories, they won't last. Now, she doesn't have the language to make them eternal. The discovery of this book seems to be that a child likes to say and.
She coins a lot of words, and she misuses. That's the moment in which a child has mastered a cliche, but then kind of hybridizes it with another cliche, or uses, say, the word emerge, that someone is totally emerged in a book, as opposed to immersed, or forfeiting one's obligations versus fulfilling it. There's all these complicated, fossilized phrases that she has to master are part of it. So she does say "and," but that was the other reason I wanted to write the book, was that it seemed to be a lot of linguistic richness there that was not going to last, I guess.
Well, it seemed also that there's a sense of what a child's time is like. That's always the next thing, you know. Like if you ask your child to say what happened when she saw a movie, it's and then and then and then, and very little feeling or consequence attached. It's almost as if this is largely a world until the end. A shoe falls and we wait for the second shoe. A girl is bullied and we wait and wait and wait in this book for this bullying to be redressed. In a sense, it never is, except that Nori gets a kindness medal for having been the one nice one to her friend Pamela. But there's a wonderful sense of the disappearance of cause and effect and consequence in this book that seems related to finding a language which will express things that can be in a child's mind and not a thing more,
no violations of the boundaries there. That seems to be the rule.
Yes, although I didn't always follow it, and then I would sometimes there's an analysis of the straw that broke the camel's back. How would a straw break a camel's back, and how would you strap on that much straw, and all that kind of thinking, which was mostly true to the way my own daughter Alice thought. But then I had thought a great deal about this, and that's another strange thing about the book, because of course some of the ideas that she's overheard from conversations between my wife and me. So there's sort of I'm chronicling something that I've also influenced.
Now tell me, would you do me a favor? I know that this is rare and I almost never ask it, but Nicholson Baker is so consistently categorized as the writer who one cannot anticipate what he will do next. The one can only create a logic to his work retrospectively. But what are you thinking about working on next?
What
were you afraid of?
I thought you were going to ask me to tap dance or something. I don't often do this, and I thought, oh, God. I've got several boxes full of file folders, I feel it's almost like, I don't know, this is not a good simile, but you know that they're the eggs in the ovary kind of queue up and the next egg pops out and you sort of have no choice about which egg that's going to be. It's very indelicate, but I want there seem to be only a few books that are possible to write after the previous book is written, and that's really all I'll say about that. I'd like to do another pseudo-scholarly thing because they're refreshing to me. They're tiresome to others, maybe, but they're a lot hard work, and it gives me an excuse to go to the library and all that. So that's one box, and then there are two novels, that one of which will get finished.
I've been speaking to Nicholson Baker on the occasion of the publication of The Everlasting Story of Nori, published by Random House. Thank you very much for joining me, Nicholson.
Oh, thank you, Michael. Thanks.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineers were Bob Carlson and J.C. Swadek. Special production assistants, Alan Howard. Development, Beverly Walker. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week for Bookworm.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse, Mouse Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.